Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Fundamentalists Podcast. It's an extra early episode for you today, Monday morning, April 13th. Is that what it is?
I think so, yeah.
What a nightmare. Time is flying, everybody. We hope you had an enjoyable Easter. If you didn't see last week's episode, we talked about the meaning of life. It was sort of me interviewing Pete, trying to decipher everything that he, you know, thinks about things, and it's an excellent episode. It's also an episode where we soft launched our Patreon, patreon.com/thefundamentalists. Thank you to all of you who have signed up already. We have almost made it to the point where we can actually support this and it won't be losing money. And I think that's pretty exciting.
Yeah,
Pete,
I think it's pretty good.
Congratulations.
After only 2 years.
Yeah, it only took 2 years. Wow. And we're in the black a little bit, almost.
We're
still in the red. But we'll get there. But yes, thank you guys. And we're excited to get that thing fleshed out and get it looking good and build a little community and make it all very fun. But in the meantime, we thought we would go back to basics on this particular episode and we would talk about fundamentalism. So this is the Fundamentalists Podcast talking about fundamentalism. Okay. Pete is a philosopher or a writer, because he doesn't like to be called that, I don't think.
Yeah, oh no, we talked about that last week, but it was more just, what I meant is just I don't teach philosophy at university. I'm trained as a philosopher, so I am a philosopher, but I don't teach at a university.
Okay.
Yeah.
I thought maybe you were not wanting to sound like that's quite a word to use to describe one's job.
Is that right? Freelance philosopher?
I'm a bit of a philosopher. I'm trained as a philosopher. And it's lovely. And it's all going to be very smart. So I'm very excited about it. But Pete has fleshed out some, I think, points on what fundamentalism is, how it's defined. And I have my definition of it. And I'm excited to see how it compares and contrasts with Pete. But first, Pete, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, man. I'm on a 3-day fast.
Yeah, you were telling me that because you were having a good birthday week.
I suppose, which was 2 weeks ago now. But yeah, I did. I felt that I'd been eating too much, drinking too much. I felt I was lacking focus. And then, so I woke up yesterday and thought, I'm just going to take a break from eating. And the whole day went by and I went, oh, that was actually, I felt good for it. So I'm going to do 3 days to kickstart kind of more focus and get fitter again because now the gym's open.
Nice.
All of that. So I thought, I'll give
the
it a go.
Exercise, man. That's the best. It's the best thing for feeling happy, I think. Just a little bit.
Although I have to, I pretend that I like it. I don't really like it. But what I do is I wake up and go, oh, I'll feel great. This will be really nice. But I hate it. Really.
I did it this morning. And I, before I came over here, I was like, I'm going to get up early. I'm going to work out. I'm going to go to Pete's. We're going to knock out this podcast. I'm going to go home, get school stuff done. It's going to be wonderful. And then when that alarm went off, I was like, I hate this so much. But you enjoy getting up early, at least.
Oh, yeah, I love getting up early. That's my thing.
Are you thinking
I went to the cinema yesterday, by the way.
Really?
On my own. I just was sitting there and going, like, there's a cinema around the corner. I thought, I wonder if it's open. And it was open. And I went to see a movie.
Cool.
Yeah, that was really nice. I was basically the only one in the theater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What movie did you see?
So I went to see The Marksman, which I thought was another movie. There's a movie called
Karl Marx, didn't you?
Yes, yeah, that's right. I was waiting for some good communism,
some
but nope. I thought it was, there's a movie called Wrath of Man that's coming out, and I saw a trailer for it, and I thought it looked fun. And for some reason, I got the wrong movie. So I sat down, and I was going, I don't know anything about this movie at all.
Yeah.
The only thing I knew 5 minutes before was that Liam Neeson was in it, who's from Northern Ireland.
That'll do.
Watch that. It was fine.
It
was nice to watch a big movie and
yeah,
it was
cool.
Kind of like a buddy road trip movie.
Like you got out. Yeah, you went into the world.
Yeah, that was nice. Wow. You went into the world. You went for a hike.
I did go for a hike.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was really amazing.
Yeah.
And we were just talking before we hit record how I think I've lost all like ability to have conversations with people, and to the point where I was just like in my head going like, I know there's like a rhythm that you get into when you're speaking with someone. Like when you have a conversation, but I couldn't find it.
Yeah.
I felt like I had like my instrument was not tuned to properly. And I was just like, this is coming off. Am I coming off like a psycho? I feel like I was coming off like I have no idea. I couldn't answer basic questions, but it was all very fun. And the hike was very pleasant. And it was also just, you know, it's funny people. Some of these people that I know, you know, they're funny. They're funny people. And that makes hiking pretty nice when you have people who have a sense of humor about it and aren't like, here we go.
Yeah.
Makes it nice.
Was it a hike? Because when I hear the word hike, I think of something pretty strenuous, pretty rough.
No. No. It was like a big trail. Like, you know, in Burbank, there's those hills and you just enjoy. I mean, it's strenuous.
Yeah.
But it's not like, when I imagine a hike, I imagine like trees all around and a little trail and like you got sticks and you're like going over rocks.
Yeah.
Not really that. It's just like dirt roads all the way up. But it's really pretty. Yeah. It's nice.
By the way, do you remember the first time we landed on the name The Fundamentalists?
Yeah, we were at that tiki bar.
Yep, that's right. And we were talking about how lots of podcasts have names that try to really define what they are, and we thought we'd pick a name that is kind of like more provocative.
Yeah, because we were at Tiki No, which is a tiki bar in North Hollywood that, oh goodness, talk about places on the bucket list. When the time is right, I'm coming back, Tiki No. But yeah, we were there because we wanted to name it something that was sounded like had an ist at the end, which we not liked. And then Fundamentalist was like the one that we. It was one of those ones where it was like, okay, this makes the most sense. But what I'm interested into about it, and what I think is very ironic about the title of this podcast, is that fundamental. I feel like I get fairly fundamentalist about things fairly often, even though it's an ironic title. I think you have beliefs and ideas that you are steadfast in, but you wouldn't say that's fundamentalism. You would just say, but when I think fundamentalism, I go, that means someone thinks that they're right and everyone else is wrong. But I think that all the time about everything.
Yeah. One of the things I like about it, actually, this is good, that the reason why I liked it was because we live in a society, a very strong...
We live in a society.
We do, there you go. And I blame society. But we live in a kind of a religious revival of purity culture, you know, so we're pure, the other's impure, and religion's always been connected with purity culture. And we always try to identify ourselves as pure and the other as impure. And I really like, funnily enough, one of the first critiques of purity culture was the Apostle Paul, who said... he called his community the I think basically the shit of the world, or the refuge and the trash of the world. So he self-identified his own community as dirty, as having problems within it. So by identifying as a fundamentalist, I like, because that word is such a negative word that people always say the other's fundamentalist, that I kind of like the idea of claiming it and saying, yeah, there's a fundamentalism within us all, and actually, if we can see our own impurities, perhaps that's the way to escape fundamentalism. So bizarrely, by seeing it within yourself is perhaps the way of breaking its hold.
Yeah.
So the fundamentalist, there you go. So I felt we were identifying with something impure.
I like how you really got this back on track there for a second. I was really going off about that hike for a second.
Oh, yeah, that was great.
No, really cool. I started falling asleep again as I was talking about it.
You're just wrecked because it's so early in the morning.
No,
how often
this is nice.
Do you get up at this
time? I exercise. I'm good.
Is that
but
right?
I also take pre-workout before I exercise. So God knows when that's going to crash.
You do a pre-workout
before powder that I put in water.
A pre-workout powder?
Pre-workout mix, yeah.
All right.
And then I drink that, and then... About 20 minutes later, I'm screaming and I'm jumping all around. And then, I kind of write it down for the rest of the day. So
that's just your morning routine. And after you've screamed and cried, you
then
work
I
out.
Work.
Yeah. Yep.
So fundamentalism.
Fundamentalism. Okay.
Let's dive in.
So I was thinking of two things. For me, fundamentalism, and see what you think of this. We can work through it and see what your definition is. But I think fundamentalism is connected to ideology and idolatry, which both come from the same root Greek word, eidos, which means, we can dive into what it means, but I think fundamentalism is a deployment of ideology and idolatry, which is a way of covering over or avoiding ontological antagonism.
Okay. We're going to need to back up, and we're going to need to review that and break those down, a lot of those words down, because I tell you, there's certain words that I know the meaning of, but then when I hear them, it's like ontological is the idea of knowing. That's how you gaining knowledge.
Well, actually being, ontology is the nature of being. So if you talk about what is...
Okay, I got it wrong.
Yeah. Well, yes, you did.
Yeah. What word was I thinking of? Ideological?
Epistemology.
Epistemology.
Epistemology is theory of knowledge, yeah, yeah. So ontology is even more basic than epistemology. Ontology is, when you talk about ontology, you're talking about what the essence of a being is, or a being itself.
Okay.
And so when I say ontological antagonism, what I'm meaning is that at the level of reality itself, there is a type of oscillation, there's a type of contradiction, and fundamentalism is an attempt to avoid confronting that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what ideology is, and that's what I would say idolatry is. Those two words are used to, and there we should break them down a little bit, but in a nutshell, I would say both of those terms describe a hiding of something hidden. They attempt to hide a lack.
Okay. I agree. And do you remember the word, the Greek word?
Eidos.
Eidos, and what is that?
So,
Eidos.
Which means idea, which is where the word idea comes from, or form. So Plato used it to talk about the forms. So basically it's the
shadows on the wall.
Yes, and then getting beyond, getting outside the cave and seeing the, kind of like getting behind the curtain.
Yeah.
Right? That was kind of like that, and that's why ideology is a little bit about that. It's about ideas that purport to give you the insight into how reality works.
Cool.
But the word has changed a lot over time. So it started off meaning just ideas. Your ideology is your way of looking at the world. And then with Marx and Engels, it became the idea that ideology was anything that hid the material circumstances of the world. So ideology was the idea that ideas are where the action is. And it covered over class antagonisms and conflicts, and they were materialists, so the material factors of reality. Then after that, ideology became, kind of developed into the notion that ideology with Žižek is an attempt to avoid a confrontation with the ultimate contingency of reality. So ideology is what gives us a sense of meaning and stability, mm-hmm. and the way things are, the way things should be, and that kind of develops.
And so what's the difference between what Žižek is saying and what Marx and the other ones?
Okay, yeah. So that, so Marx is basically saying that what the real engine of change in the world is material circumstances.
Yeah.
How we produce things, how we barter, how we exchange. So that's, and everything else covers over that. So religion maybe says this is the way things are supposed to be. The rich man at his castle, the poor man at his gate, God made them high and lowly and ordered their estate, right? From the hymn, All Things Bright and Beautiful. So religion basically tries to cover over the true material circumstances, which is just some people have stuff, some people don't, and the conflicts. Žižek,
none of that matters, because you just got to believe this idea. Yeah. As long as you get this thing, no matter what it is, even if it's not religious, even if it's political, if you believe this thing the right way, then you'll be fine.
You'll be fine. And also, and everything that's happening is the way it should happen.
And so that's just how it is.
That's how it is.
Because you got to think about the idea.
Yeah.
Well, if you believe in the idea, of course it's going to happen.
Yeah, like almost behind the scenes, God or nature or fate dictates this. So if you have a true insight, so education and maybe, so the educational system, the judicial system, the religious system, insofar as they're ideological, are kind of saying, oh, the way things are at the moment is the way they should be. It's the way, it's just the way the universe or God or nature dictates reality.
So Marx was against ideology?
Yes. So he was ideology critique.
That sounds pretty ideological to be like, all of the ideology is just masking over the class system, the classes. Isn't that the same thing? You're just sort of reshuffling the deck a little bit?
You maybe could argue that could be an ideology, but what he would say is that ideology is what makes temporal contingent reality into something eternal.
Mm.
So he would say, like, anything that exposes the conflicts within society and the fact, the historicity of things, that everything is moving, changing, that we can imagine new worlds, that there are different ways of configuring reality. Marx would say that is ideology critique.
Something that keeps you away from that.
Something that keeps you away from the idea that the way things are are the way they have to be.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
That covers over everything and says, listen, almost even today, it's like saying that the system is fine. It's just there's a few little problems. We get rid of the few little problems and it continues to function. Marx would say that's ideology. So ideology critique, or what's called historical materialism, is the notion that you see the conflicts and the historicity of reality.
Yeah, okay. Sense.
But you could, but you know, you're saying, but yeah, what about, is that not an ideology?
No, yeah, I think that, and then would that be, but I guess, would that be, that wouldn't be fundamentalism then?
No, although I think it's connected, so.
Fundamentalism is a type of ideology.
Yeah.
I mean, we're getting there, folks.
Yeah, because I'd almost want to make a distinction between secular fundamentalism and sacred fundamentalism. So for me, secular fundamentalism is ideological. And sacred fundamentalism is idolatry.
Yeah, I see.
But the funny thing is, what happened after Marx with Žižek through a guy called Althusser is the idea that ideology functions.
Althusser is the vaccine I got.
Oh, is that? Yeah, that's right. ideology kind of ultimately functions to cover over the central antagonisms within culture. Ultimately, we don't want to face the contingency of reality.
Which is all messed up.
It's all messed up. So it's very, it kind of comes out of the same kind of root, but it's slightly different because it brings in this concept of the real, which is, so in traditional Marxism, you have this tendency of thinking that there is a non-antagonistic future, communism. There's a way of getting to a future that where antagonism doesn't exist.
Utopia.
Yeah, a utopia. And Žižek is very critical of that utopic thinking. He says, no, that itself is ideology. Ideology always has a vision of some non-antagonistic reality where everything's great as long as we get rid of certain group of people or a certain group of ideas.
Could you extend that to, you know how, not going to name names, but some people at the end of the day will have a lot of drinks and it becomes like they have so many drinks that they're wanting also to escape the contradiction and the reality of life.
Yeah.
And it's still the same because you're still trying to, you're still going, there's a utopia. If I can just get out of my brain a little bit, then I'll be happy.
I mean, I think kind of at its root, alcoholism, you will often find, is what's that?
They're spirits.
and you'll find at the very core of it, often, some trauma that the person's trying to get away from, something, some antagonism that they're trying to cover over. I think most addictions are that. Yep. And the difference between an addiction and not an addiction is you can have a few drinks because you want to relax. But if you have this compulsion,
Right.
drink to get away from the contradiction,
get to that utopia,
get rid of the complexity of life. Yeah.
Do you think that we're living in an era of fundamentalists?
I think there's a revival of secular fundamentalism. Secular purity culture.
Yeah,
it's very religious because religion has always been connected with what's dirty and what's clean, what's pure and what's impure. So religions have always been kind of both literally and metaphorically.
Yeah.
And also religion at its most mature has always been a critique of purity culture, always saying that, hold on, maybe the dirt's within you, not within the other. And so I do see kind of ideology. We live in an age of ideology and an age of purity culture.
It's definitely.
Religion is alive and well.
It is, and it's an unfortunate situation. Now, are there different kinds of fundamentalism? We've talked about previously about doing multiple episodes on the fundamentalism of certain things, looking at the ways that these things could be viewed through a fundamentalist lens or critiqued in that way. How far does this go? I mean, you can't really get rid of this. You can't escape it. It's going to be in everything.
Yeah.
Right? Like, there's no way you can not be a little bit. Otherwise, what you have to stand for something at some point. You have to be like, this is what I think is going to help the world. Therefore, this I'm going to do. And it's still in doing that, you're banking on like a utopia in some way because you're banking on at least improvement.
Yeah. Well, see, yeah. So the way out, potentially, here's what I would say the way out is, there's no way out. But weirdly, as you embrace that there's no way out, that's the escape. So it's like purely, it's like whenever you begin to see, for example, if you're projecting all of your inner darkness onto somebody else. And then you begin to say, oh my goodness, I'm projecting that. That's partly within me. You're not escaping it, but by coming to know it, by coming to symbolize it, by coming to put it into language, you find a certain purchase on it, a certain freedom from it. That's why I like that we call ourselves a fundamentalist, because weirdly, by identifying with it, you subvert it.
Yeah, you that, make yeah. You rob it of its power. You make it from unconscious to conscious. Bring it to the surface.
And ultimately, kind of for me, it's like, and see that antagonism. That's the core of my work, is like that we somehow most of the damage that's done in society is precisely because we want to avoid the lack. We want to avoid this black hole within us and within society. And actually, that's what causes all the problems.
And we buy and we buy and we buy.
Yeah. And purchasing is a kind of way of always trying to think the next thing's going to fill the lack, fill the gap, fill the hole.
You know, I've been on this real kick lately, Pete, with these tuna products. Mm. Now, I don't mean to talk about food on a day that you're fasting, but I hope this isn't appetizing to you at all. I like them. They come in little cups. It's really easy for me to consume. It's a tiny little bit of tuna. It's like tuna intimations or something like that. It's weird. Mm. Imaginations, some kind of I word. And I buy them off of Amazon like a psychopath. And I buy them a couple cases at a time.
I do something similar with these little shots of just vegetables and stuff. So you buy the little...
Yeah, they come in cardboard boxes. And
they're single, serve.
But then, so I'm enjoying these. I'm like, this is a nice, like modest snack / lunch during the day when I don't want to.
It gives you the illusion that it's fixing all of the vices that you have.
Exactly. Yeah, this will solve it. This too. Yeah. Well, wouldn't you know it, I turn on this documentary called Seaspiracy.
Oh.
Which a friend of a
it
friend
sounds
said
right
it
up your
called.
Street.
Yeah. Some exact. I was like, I love both of those words smashed together. I love the sea and I love conspiracies. But a friend of a friend said it should be conspiracy, like conspira, S-E-A. Anyway, that's a different podcast. But it was, the whole documentary was just like, you can't eat fish anymore. Don't ever eat fish. And I was like, crap. I got really into this fish. And now I know if I just keep eating the fish, I'm going to get tired of the tuna. And I'm going to, because that's what I do. I'll get one type of thing and I'll eat it for like a couple weeks. And then I get bored and I move on to the next thing. So I'm going to get, naturally in due time, we'll start eating less tuna. But the whole thing was like, yeah, you want to save the planet, you just stop eating fish. Like, above everything else. They went into the plastic straw thing. They went into the recycling thing. They went into like cars and like what's causing the most damage, and then they went and they looked at the fisheries across the globe, and I was like, okay, so all we have to do is stop eating fish and we will have a utopia.
Is that right? Because we are just sucking the sea dry of like fish, are we? We're
going through a lot of fish.
Yeah. Yeah. I've kind of seen some of those stats. It seems like a lot.
It seems like a lot of fish. Yeah. Yeah. I'm doing my part and I feel bad about it, but it was definitely one of those things where I was like, I there's so few things that I just compulsively buy a lot of. But tuna happened to have become one of them, and I was like, all right.
Jellyfish, is it not true that we have to learn how to eat jellyfish? Because there's so many of those.
Really?
But most people don't like to eat jellyfish. There are some countries where some people eat jellyfish.
Really?
Yeah.
Ugh.
It doesn't sound nice to me. But there are some, I think somewhere in Asia, there's some that's a delicacy in some places. And I'm sure they do it nicely. But basically, I was reading... We're gonna have to all learn to like jellyfish.
Yeah, we're gonna figure this out pretty soon. We're gonna start eating jellyfish.
So, what's the conspiracy, by the way, of the sea? What is there?
It's all the tuna organic crap. Oh, yeah. It's all like the organic thing is a complete racket, especially in that area. And then he like tracks who owns the companies that are doing the fish, and how they're all connected. They're all owned by the same people, and then they have like stamps that they sell that say like, you know, fresh, like farm fresh or something like that. And it never is. They make money off of these branding things. It's very interesting. I know very little about any of that stuff. So I'm always just like, whatever the thing is going to be. This is why also I don't tend to watch documentaries about food. Had I known this was going to be about food, I probably wouldn't have done it. I don't like watching Super Size Me. I don't like knowing what's in the Big Mac. I don't like getting my creature comforts taken away from me. Yeah. And this is a very small, you know, stupid thing to complain about, but it reminded me when you were talking about consuming and trying to fill the hole constantly. I was like, oh yeah, we are just destroying everything too in the process.
And that is a good way of thinking about what commodity fetishism is. Because commodity fetishism is the idea that...
You think I have a tuna fetish?
You've got a tuna fetish.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's like, in commodity fetishism, the idea of fetish and religion is an object that you create. You make the god, and then you think that the god has just appeared. And you're... So it's kind of... It connects actually with fundamentalism, is this idea of ideology. Is for Marx, we create the world. But then when we create the world, we then start to think that creation is eternal and comes, you know, we experience it from outside of ourselves. And commodity fetishism is that we go into a supermarket and we see commodities. And they seem these magical things that just appear in supermarkets that you just buy and you consume the tuna. But actually, that's... conceals all of these relations that span thousands of people all around the world.
It never ends.
Never ends. It has all these connections. But when we don't know that, we can consume these. We treat it as this fetish object that's just a magical thing. The car is just there. But actually, we're divorced from seeing all of the social relations, all of the people who have been exploited or whatever in that chain.
Yeah.
And so... documentaries like that, they just expose the truth that this little tin that you've got is actually connected with the end of the world.
Yeah, it doesn't taste as good since I watched the documentary. Yeah.
But the problem is that'll be the same with your shirt. That'll be the same with this chess set. It'll be the same with these microphones.
But you gotta choose something, you know? Because, I know that argument of like, I mean, everything is... your iPhones, that's a big one.
Yeah. Oh no, but I'm the opposite. I'm going like we need to know. Like I'm going like we let's expose.
Just look at it. Yeah.
Yeah, like let's begin, because if you actually, and it's very hard to do, but if you actually see all of that complexity, it kind of sickens you of the whole thing. You start to wonder, oh, is there a different way of us relating and purchasing and doing so, you know, and you start to think about different ways of doing the world. But until you see it, you don't start to imagine different ways.
Yeah, could I order from, I don't know, anyone other than Amazon? Like, is there maybe a better company out there? Not that they're not incredible. Did you see what they were doing with that Amazon news account?
No, what happened?
That was some insane stuff, dude. They're on Twitter, like, blasting Bernie Sanders from the verified Amazon news account that says Amazon News. And they're, like, mocking him and, like, replying to him and sticking up for, like, and being like, our employees love this. That none of this is true. This is silly.
Oh, I heard about that.
And Bernie Sanders, what has he ever done with it? And it was just so weird because it was like the handle, it was just weird seeing Amazon News, the handle, like getting pithy with people.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah, all these corporations are, you know, they're all, I would say they're all woke washing, which is like, they're all jumping on what the current ideology is,
but they
get very nervous when you actually hit on the actual oppressions
that
are existing, you know, because that has to be hidden. Like it, all of that oppression has to be under the surface. When you get into an Uber, you don't want to see bottles of urine. Right, that's the thing that has to be hidden.
Unless they're mine.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm bringing them with me.
Yeah. So yeah, it's all hidden.
Yeah,
it's all hidden.
Yeah, it's I know, man. That tuna now just doesn't. It hits different.
Yeah. But it's incredible how quick we can forget. Like, I mean, we all live within so it's not. That's what I mean. There's no outside of the system. So I'm very critical of the idea with Althusser, which is. By merely not identifying with the system is a act of resistance, which I think is interesting. Is where basically you don't respond to the ideology. You try to kind of like live outside of it in some respects, but there is no outside of it. You know that, but there is a way somehow of like. This is why I'm a Hegelian. It's like, for me, the political act is exposing the horror of everything. Not so much what the next step is, just expose the reality for what it is.
You just have to look at the vomit a little bit.
Yeah.
It's like there's poop on the living room floor, and we're all walking around every day pretending that there's not poop in the living room floor. and we just need to look at it and be like, someone needs to clean this up.
Yeah.
But then you find out that there's poop in every room, and then you find out that the walls are made of poop, and then you find out that, you know, even the water is coming out brown. It's crazy. Sorry, that's just getting gross.
Yeah. But and then and the problem with ideology is ideology, and this is what Todd McGowan talks about, but for him, ideology is what always provides a way of explaining, of kind of like...
justifying almost?
Justifying, yeah, justifying, rationalizing, and rendering contingent, saying that... And kind of like offering fake solutions.
You're kind of repressing it. Yeah, you're just going like, you can look the other way, and you can pretend everything's fine, and no one will ever bother you.
Yeah, yeah.
And this and is why if someone does, you just go, well, you do it too.
Yeah, yeah. And this is why fundamentalism in its religious and secular form is so appealing, because it offers us a way of either avoiding a confrontation with these antagonisms, or a way of like giving us an easy solution to rather than seeing them as inherent to the system. This is a difficult thing, because like every system has an inherent antagonism that if you get rid of it, you destroy the system itself. And so in political theory, the idea is that if you want to create a new system, you have to hit the central antagonism of the current system. You have to expose it, bring it to light. It becomes so distasteful to so many people, that system collapses and something new arises. That's kind of the Hegelian kind of...
You're really smart, Pete.
Oh, well, thank you.
It's really smart stuff.
But in terms of fundamentalism, yeah, maybe that's a... You know, people think of it in terms of religion.
That's the other thing too I like about the podcast, as it is not typically about super religious things. It kind of mixes in, and then it gets mostly some kind of loosely political and philosophical and covering all these things. It's very nice, but yeah, I don't think of it that way. I mean, the people I've heard stories like the old school kind of fundamentalist group is still out there that. You know, is in the South and in certain parts of the country, and it's still very prevalent. And I've heard recent tales of those sorts of communities, and they do seem now so foreign to me that it's almost weird. It's like an alternate reality a little bit when I hear these tales. But I was like, I still wouldn't define the majority of when I think the word fundamentalist, I think of people who I see in LA, which is of an incredibly, I would say, fundamentalist religious place, just without the churches, and it's more just a strange, like, I mean, but what do I know anymore anyway? I haven't been out there. Who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe we've all just grown up and changed, and everyone's going to be really chill and laid back, but I doubt it.
Yeah. If there's one thing I know about LA, it's going to be interesting.
Well, I went to a party a week ago or 2 weeks ago and it was... a lot of young LA kind of entrepreneurs, and I was very interested in how much ideology was in that space.
Yeah.
for Marx, interestingly, in his he wrote a famous piece called "The Critique of Hegel's Philosophy of Right," an introduction to the Critique of Hegel's Philosophy of Right, and that's where the famous line "Religion is the opiate of the people" comes from. But in that, he starts it off saying, the critique of religion is the beginning of all critique. And what he means is that fundamentalism doesn't go away when you critique it. It just becomes secular. And so there's notions that are in religion filter into secular society, and those have to be critiqued. So for me, there's definitely still religious fundamentalism, but it just doesn't have as much power.
Yeah.
Because idolatry is the notion of a god that you can see, that you can hold in your hand, that is the essence, that covers over this traumatic real of God, kind of the unnameable, the one that you can't have a graven image of. And so, yeah, religious fundamentalism is just a clear way of seeing secular fundamentalism, because in religious fundamentalism, God gets rid of all antagonism. God says, God is the way to go. Well, it might be shit at the moment, but it'll be better in the next life. Or the way of saying, well, the way of the world is
it doesn't get rid of the contradiction, but because it's still going, you're suffering.
Yeah.
But so, it'll be okay. It still gives you a narrative, a meta-narrative. Just give meaning when, okay.
Exactly, and that's what Marx means by the opiate of the people, because he says, like, religion is the opiate of the people.
Instagram is the opiate of the people.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely it is now. But he says, it's the heart of a heartless world, the soul of a soulless condition. And then he says,
Twitter.
Is that Twitter? And he says, and then he goes on to say that it's the encyclopedia of the human condition, something similar to that. But it's beautiful. It's a beautiful line, like the soul of a soulless condition, the heart of a heartless world. Like he says it's the imaginary flowers on the chains of our oppression. And he says, we must get rid of the imaginary flowers, not so that we see the chains in despair, but so that we can see the chains, break them, and pick living flowers. So for Marx, religion wasn't bad. Like it was an opiate, it was a painkiller. It helped us deal with our suffering, just like getting drunk can help us deal with our suffering. The only problem is that it covers over the oppression. It doesn't help us actually see it and break free from it. And basically, imaginary flowers are always nicer than real flowers. The only problem is you can't pick them, you can't smell them, you can't you can't hold them. So it's like that. And so he asks, what is the opiate of today?
Yeah. So when was he around, this Marx guy? What was
1840s to 1910s or whatever.
Yeah. So that's coming off of 400 years of the. About 300 of the Protestant Reformation and all that.
Oh yeah, I guess so. From Luther, yeah.
So that's only three or four generations, I guess. No, it was a generation, 20 years. I mean, like, his great granddad was probably, he knew about all that. He was there for that.
And he was very, I mean, Marx will have, that whole, funny, Feuerbach, who was a very big Lutheran, was influenced Marx. So it kind of comes out of that Protestant kind of Reformation kind of tradition. Why, what are you thinking about that?
Jung talks about the Protestant Reformation or the proliferation of Protestants following the Protestant Reformation and sort of how they kind of compared to the Catholic Church, kind of fell apart, and just in terms of, once there was no centralized belief system that everyone was sort of a part of, and that then Protestants went off and just became a billion different groups, all with different, we disagree here on this little thing and here on this little thing. And I think the argument is something like, it just basically, it helped push forward the lack of satisfaction or potency that religion had prior. And so then everything, his whole thing was like, this just isn't working for people anymore. Like, people aren't going to church. They're not getting what they in antiquity may have been able to get out of it, because it's just not there anymore. And so that's what I was thinking about.
Very good. And there's a sense in which Protestantism secularized in a very big way that Catholicism didn't so much, is that from Luther, you have then Hegel, and Hegel basically philosophizes theology. So Hegel makes the crucifixion of Christ into a philosophical concept.
Yeah.
And then after Hegel, you go into Feuerbach, who secularizes Lutheran theology, and then Marx. And then, you've also got Nietzsche in there as a kind of secular Protestant. It is interesting. Protestantism has had a massive effect on philosophy.
Really?
Hegel's kind of partly responsible, and Marx is in that line.
Cool.
Yeah.
I need to read Hegel. I need to do it, but I'm not going to do it right now.
You're doing a lot of reading. What are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading about complexes, and I'm reading about archetypes. Mm. The complexes are very interesting, and, no pun intended, slightly complex.
Yeah.
Learn about object relations theory. That was really interesting. Theory of emotions, where emotions come from. Difference between Freudian schools of thought being that emotion comes from ego, and then depth psychology saying emotions come from complexes, unconscious complexes, and they get constellated from the unconscious. So they spring forth, they act as autonomous, almost like splinter psyches, as Jung said. And so learning about all the different ways complexes happen, and then in the context of depth psychology, how multiple complexes can be activated at the same time, and what's going on there, and worry when you're actually seeing someone as someone or as they are, or to the best of your ability, or you're seeing them from, you know, whatever you're projecting onto them, which is most commonly how you find out what your complexes are.
Okay. So the funny thing is, so complex is a word that's more Jungian word. So it's actually not a word that I come across much. How would you define complex? Is it, I wonder if it's
feeling toned group of a feeling toned reaction toward or a bundle. Yeah, it's like a archetypally based constellated behaviors, emotionally toned behaviors that happen as a result of usually they have a trauma at their core. So if you're in a complex, I don't know what got into me. I don't know what came over me. I don't know why I said that. I don't know who I was just there. You're not you when you're hungry. That kind of thing is an indicator that you're in a complex, because you sort of, your ego kind of takes a back seat to the complex and you kind of lose yourself in the moment.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's funny, like, cause I've read a bit of Jung, but complex is just not a word that's used much in psychoanalysis.
No, it's not. Freud, I guess, used it, liked it, but then kind of got away from it real quick. And then Freud said dreams are the royal road to the unconscious. And then Jung was like, no, complexes are the royal road to the unconscious. And their idea is that complexes, even though he says it's not a royal road, it's a very tumultuous, twisting path and very hard. But he says complexes basically are the building blocks of the unconscious.
Okay. Okay. So, we'll need to talk more, but we should do an episode on complexes, because I'd like to, and I'll do some reading on it, because I'm kind of new to it.
I can give you some stuff to read, because it's really interesting, but some of it I don't totally agree with. It seems like a really heavy emphasis on complexes, but at the same time, it also, a lot of it makes a ton of sense, and they're also saying, like, basically, this is me rambling, sorry, but the complexes are like constantly amorphous and changing, and the theory on it is changing, and there's no like set theory, and so it's a lot of simultaneous ideas at once kind of hitting me. But I want you to send you, there's one particular paper I really liked. I really liked the one on emotions, and that was interesting because it was just very like, he makes a little graph, and it just sort of shows, you know, the ego kind of dip down when the energy of the complex rises, it gets activated by whatever. You know, your partner doesn't do the dishes, that kind of thing.
Okay, because it sounds like what we called, what in psychoanalysis might be called compulsion repetition or something.
Repetition compulsion. Yeah, that's one of the ones that they mentioned that in one of the things. Repetition compulsion, and it's you keep doing the same thing, and you find yourself in these same type, and they can never go away. A complex can never, like, you can't just recognize it. Recognizing it doesn't do anything. So you have to basically free the libido from the complex that has been stored up into something else, which would be, I guess, sublimation, if we're talking in that realm.
I mean, yes, this does have like similarities then to, I'm starting to be able to place it.
What I know. Because I know that, we can talk about all that in a separate thing, but I have to go read more of it today and talk about it.
The funny thing is, from psychoanalytic perspective, this kind of repetition compulsion is exactly where your freedom is, which I find fascinating. So like in philosophy, they talk about positive and negative freedom. And so positive freedom is the idea that your desire is not internally generated. It doesn't come from an external chain of events. And then negative freedom says that, well, no, your desire is to do with all of these, a chain of cause and effects. But what freedom is simply, can you act on your desire? So if you're a monk and you put yourself in a cell and the cell door is locked, you can't get out, but you're free because you don't want to get out. Your desire is to stay in the cell. So whereas if you want to get out and you can't, you're not free.
Yeah.
But in psychoanalysis, you have this notion that your freedom is precisely the eruption of something that destabilizes you. Mm-hmm. So it's weirdly the thing that you feel most unfree, the thing that comes up that you think is least you, is actually the evidence of your freedom. So it's fascinating.
That's very, very, very similar to a lot of what the papers I was reading. I mean, it's hard to keep track of it because I just go through and I highlight things, I move on and I highlight and I move on. But it was making a whole case about, like, and Jung said this too, like, the complexes are a sign that that something is up that you can actually grapple with, and people freak out about them, and no one likes to look at their complexes. No one likes to think they have an inferiority complex or mother complex or any of that stuff. But when you recognize it and you start working with it, then yeah, I mean, it's basically going, you can experience some version of freedom and some version of a new life after that.
Very good.
It's okay. Nice.
Nice, nice.
It's all very fun.
Yeah. So here, what you were saying about your thoughts on fundamentalism, did you have a definition or a kind of feel? Because you grew up in a kind of... Would you say you grew up in a fundamentalist environment?
Evangelical, so I guess fundamentalist. Is that... Yeah, pretty fundamentalist.
Can be, yeah. I think sometimes it not necessarily, but I think, to be honest, yeah, generally. Yeah.
I went to... there was a couple years I went to a really Baptist school as a kid, and I was like in fourth and fifth grade, and that was pretty wild. Those people were fundamentalists.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. But I still... I don't know that I even worry too much about the religious aspect anymore, like the sort of different things, because I feel like that's... I almost feel like that's better than a lot of the fundamentalism that I see. I mean, I know I'm just closer to it out here, and it's too much, but it's I get more worried about it out here. For me, I view fundamentalism as I know it when I see it. It's that person that's on Twitter that tweets all the time about one particular thing, and they're really angry about it, and they take it really seriously. And then I go, this person seems like they're really on one about this. Some people come off like pastors with no congregation on Twitter. Like, they're just shouting these like big sermons or these big threads. And I'm like, you seem like you got maybe a little something going on.
Yeah. And that brings up, something that I was wanting to talk about, which is, you know, the most common form of fundamentalism, a mistake that people make is they think that fundamentalism is certainty. That, you know, a fundamentalist is someone who is certain about what they believe.
But I would say that it's not. Well,
But see if you agree with this, that the idea is actually that for neurotic fundamentalism, it's actually repressed uncertainty. That it's a reaction formation. Is that the more angry you are at somebody who disagrees with you, there's something that's repressed, some doubt or unknowing within yourself that is being projected out. So actually, most of us, when we grow up, we think we know how the world is because we don't know anything different. We're not fundamentalists. Fundamentalism is not being certain of something. But the point whenever you're confronted with difference and you close your ears to it and you go like, I don't want to listen, that's when fundamentalism arises as a repressed uncertainty. That's what you see on Twitter sometimes or in social media, is when if someone is very angry and fighting something, if they're neurotic, you'll generally find that they're fighting a repressed part of themselves.
Yeah.
It's projected onto somebody else. Projective identification. So they project onto the other some, like, they're the angry one. They're intolerant. They want a silence. And then the irony is...
That's a complex.
That would be called a complex in Jungian.
In Jungian psychology, we call it a complex.
Right. Very good. Well, so that act, the funny thing is for Melanie Klein, who talks about projective identification, so you project onto somebody else. But then, weirdly, if I keep shouting at you and saying, you're angry, you're intolerant, you're bigoted, you're trying to silence people.
It's 8 a.m.
Yes, I know. Yeah. But eventually, you'll be going like, I'm not angry. And then you'll get, I'm not angry. And you'll get angry. And then I'm able to identify with that anger, which is weirdly,
exactly what I was just reading about yesterday.
Oh, is that right? Oh,
That would be to complex activating another complex. And then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy where you basically aren't seeing someone as they are. You're projecting your own crap onto them. You project that. And in doing so, they react accordingly. They take on that persona that you're giving them. Neither of you is actually who you are at that point. You're both just...
And then
later you do it again. And then the person feels right, which makes it more embedded. And then it continues on and on.
Yes, yes. And so in Kleinian language, that's... So there's projective identification where I put onto you... But you might not actually... be triggered by it, but if you are, it's great because then I identify.
Yeah.
But if you are triggered, it's a projective counter identification where you basically you become angry because you're being told you're angry so much. And then of course it's great because weirdly, I identify with you because I'm identifying with a repressed part of myself.
Yep.
Like, there's a part of myself, but it can also be good things. For Kleinianism, it's like I might have grown up in an environment where if I shone too much and showed my intelligence, it pissed off my siblings. So I repressed my intelligence. So I look at other people and see them as intelligent, and I project intelligence onto the other. And then if they show that, I like them and I really identify with them, but I'm actually identifying with a part of myself yeah. that is repressed. So it goes positively mm-hmm. and negatively, but I do find it is interesting how whenever you see someone who's going like, you're angry, you're intolerant, often they want the other to become that so that they can identify themselves externally from themselves.
Yeah, yeah. That makes sense. I was also reading similarities to what you're saying with just the being in love. Is very similar to being in the throes of one of those complexes, because you're basically, you're not yourself. You have completely put on to another person something that is absolutely beyond them. And you can, you know, it can still become a truly loving relationship where you can see someone closer to what they actually are. But the in love state is just, it's insanity. It's like, yeah. It's basically you've lost your mind.
Yes. And sometimes the best thing you can have is that where the projection you're putting onto the other person, they like it, as in they enjoy playing that role in your theatrical performance, and you enjoy playing their role in their theatrical performance.
Role playing.
And that can be quite nice.
You're talking about role playing.
Yes, that's basically because kind of role playing is like a very explicit version of kind of what we're always doing. I think psychologically, I think that's why we can do role playing.
Yeah.
You can do role playing because it's already a psychic structure that you're already doing.
And the maid outfit just feels nice.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's comfortable.
Love that. Well, I've enjoyed this episode very much.
Yeah, me too.
It's kind of chill. It's a nice little chill episode. How do you guys feel? Did you enjoy it? If you're listening to this, please let us know. If you'd like to check out patreon.com/thefundamentalists, we're trying to get this thing improved and better than ever.
And once we're able to pay for the basic stuff, then we'll be paying for the alcohol. That's the second level.
Then it gets really good.
Yeah. And then the third level is when we get that yacht.
How's your hunger level doing after all that tuna talk?
You know, funny thing is, I wonder if people can tell my energy is a little bit down, but I'm feeling great. Like, I literally was going to do a one-day fast, and then it was so easy. I was like, oh, this was easy. I used to do them all the time when I was in my 20s, just as a kind of a will thing. But I haven't done it for 20 years, but I'm like, that wasn't bad. So today, if I can get through today, then...
Well, if you want, maybe after your you know, I mean, I'm immune to the disease mostly. So maybe when you're done, we could get a bite to eat somewhere, maybe at a food truck or something.
I would love that. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. That'd be really nice. Be outside, have a nice time. And I just think it'd be funny to see you absolutely starving.
Yes.
I'd be like, let's go. We gotta go. Gotta eat. So you're going to go 3 days? You can make it
three days, yeah.
That's awesome, man.
And then fourth day, I just want to do like sushi and salad. It's kind of almost a kickstart to just kind of getting more focus.
You've already forgotten about the fish thing.
Oh, yeah, that's right. How dare you?
It happens. It's crazy. Yeah, let me know if you want any tuna. Anyway, thank you guys so much. Please let us know in the comments what you liked about it
and what you didn't like about it. You can tell us how to improve this. You know?
We love you. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.